Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hi, I'm the runaway log through the car window on the freeway, Megan Rosati.
And I'm hashtag for Chris, hashtag Chris did nothing wrong, hashtag justice for Chris, hashtag please don't date me and then turn me into a tree, Danielle Radford.
Welcome to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast, a Stage 13 original series that is an immersion into the unique worlds created by each episode of the hit anthology series on the CW and Netflix.
In each episode of our podcast, we sit down with the Two Sentence Horror Stories creators, as well as celebrity guests and social activists, to deep dive into the social and cultural issues explored on the cult series
and the carefully intricate craft that went into the making of each episode.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Christian, this tech junk has taken over.
I don't have time to vacuum.
When is the last time that we got out of here and took a walk together like we used to? Mm-hmm. Chris.
I hear you.
You know, even when I'm with you, it feels really lonely.
That clip you just heard was from the season 3 episode Plant Life. Before we get into Plant Life, Danielle, how are you?
It is so wild. My current life is exactly mimicking Plant Life. I have not had a phone in like a week and I am completely losing it.
Oh my God.
Oh, I know. I had to I still have my laptop, but like it's not, I don't know, it's not the same. And so I just got my phone. And so I have been trying very hard to not every break we take go back and be like, okay, but like how do I get my SIM card? And it's like, no, you've been surviving without a phone for like a week and a half. You can take a day and not obsess about how to get back on your phone. But can I? No, I can't.
Meanwhile, I left my phone in the car for dinner and it was a full emergency because I only have my proof of vaccination on my phone. So
Samesies.
I had to search through my partner's emails to find it. And when it was taking a while, eventually the lady was like, "You're being so neurotic about this. We trust you." And they just let us go inside.
I'm glad that worked out for you. Don't do that anyone else.
Oh, yeah.
Ever.
No. So today we're discussing the episode Plant Life, where a technology addicted man receives a strange plant from his boyfriend, but soon experiences disturbing changes to his mind and body as the plant takes root in his apartment.
What's with the weird plant?
Christian, be gentle with that.
Why? It's just a... Come here. Where did you even get this thing?
It's a rescue plant. Here, look.
And you brought it here because?
Because I thought it would help you unplug and be more present. You know, connect with something that's actually alive.
You could check out this full episode on the CW and on the CW app.
You could say Plant Life is a cautionary tale about how the saturation of technology in our lives can lead us further away from grounded relationships to our loved ones and the natural world.
Joining our conversation today, we have the director of the episode, Vera Miao. Vera is a writer-director who currently co-produces AMC's Fear the Walking Dead, and she is the creator of Two Sentence Horror Stories.
Woohoo! We'll also be joined by Stephanie Adams Santos, who wrote this episode. In addition to writing several episodes across 3 seasons, Stephanie is a prolific poet whose work is rooted in the crossroads of ritual, ancestry, and environment, with a penchant for the queer and uncanny, where I live.
I can't wait. We'll also be joined by Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel, founder of Reboot and Recover, an organization that offers harm reduction solutions to our sometimes tenuous connections to technology.
And later in the show, we'll be joined by screenwriter and director Jeffrey Reddick. Jeffrey is probably best known for creating, oh, I don't know, the Final Destination franchise? I don't know if y'all have heard of that.
Screams and genre. Brah, brah, brah. Danielle, I just had a vision, and it's telling me to avoid the 405 today and every day, and also watch out for logs on a flatbed truck. That's all I have to say.
Yo, I wish someone had told me about buses, but dude, noted.
First up, Vera Miao and Stephanie Adam Santos.
Hello, Vera and Stephanie. We are legit like so pumped to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We cannot wait to talk about this episode.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, so glad. This was a really fun episode to work on.
Awesome. Well, we can't wait to hear all about it, but first off, Vera, we've been really anxious to have you on the show since you are the creator of Two Sentence Horror Stories, the series. So can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create the web series that was made into the show? And then talk a little bit about the process of turning something that was a short form web series into a longer form show, since that is the holy grail of many creators circa 2012, 2010, 2015.
I think the original inspiration, it was really, I mean, some of it is just my love of psychological horror and this desire to kind of revisit the form of Twilight Zone, which were these standalone stories in each episode that really did as much to provoke the brain and to leave you with a certain set of questions and kind of get you with a, oftentimes a twist or a stinger at the end. And just the experience of, you know, watching a show like that, that endures so many decades later, that was probably the core. I had no idea what I was doing. And I said, I would love to do psychological horror anthology show in the vein of Twilight Zone.
Not only have you been working on Two Sentence Horror Stories to update that idea of this like Twilight show-esque anthology series, the show itself, Two Sentence Horror Stories, has evolved and updated and grown over the years as far as like the themes and the tone. So how important was it to you and the rest of the team to both stay true to your vision?
I mean, I think art is, it's a live entity. It doesn't actually stay still ever. So I don't think anyone actually probably can continue to do something over however many seasons, if we're talking about a television show, and not have it necessarily evolve. But I do think the evolution was probably baked into the DNA of the show. Sort of going back to a question that Megan had asked about the transition from a digital short form series onto a linear network broadcast show. You know, that was obviously a transition that we had to make when CW picked up the show. Some of it actually translated quite well, frankly. I think there's something inherent to building in sort of like the arcs that within a single story that somehow managed to work really well for commercial breaks in a strange way. And then I think over the three seasons on the CW, for instance, as the creator of the show, and, you know, in that first digital short form series, I wrote every script, you know, I show ran the series, I directed a few of the episodes, and, you know, moving into the CW season, you know, it just becomes a bigger entity and more collaborative voices are in place. And in these last two seasons on CW, I have not been the showrunner and really stepped back and let the leadership and the vision of other folks, other voices, other talents really guide, you know, the show into whatever direction it's evolving.
I love that. And, you know, obviously we are stans who have watched every episode, but for the casual viewer who's maybe just discovering Two Sentence Horror Stories now, is there a specific episode from any season that you would say is a great starting point to understand the tone of the Two Sentence Horror Story universe?
An episode that I directed that's very close to my heart is called Ma. I think that really captured a lot of the idea and the hopes that I had for what the show would be able to deliver.
I also went straight to Ma. I think it's one of... It was for me as a writer, my North Star episode. And as a queer person who loves horror, I also really appreciated how authentic it felt. I'll say it's really rare to see queer content that is not by queer creators and feel like a really organic chemistry between the main characters. And I really felt that. I was like, oh, I'm attracted to the neighbor too. You know, it's like there's and I love the toenail scene. You know, there's just so much. I love body horror.
Oh yeah.
And so Ma has been that episode for me.
Oh,
we'll get into the body horror of it.
So Vera, you are back in the director's chair for this season's episode of Plant Life. Mm-hmm. How did that feel?
Oh, it was really, you know, honestly, it was super fun. Steph delivered an incredible script. When I read it, I was like, I want to direct this. And not just because at its core, it's like a queer couple, which obviously I personally have investment in and love. But it was just thematics and visuals really popped off the page for me. It was my first experience on the show directing without having to run anything. You know, with our showrunner, Lisa Morales, our incredible EP, Liz Levine, and then this incredible crew and cast. It was just, and Steph was there. And, you know, it was a very different experience to direct on the show with that much support and that much leadership.
Well, and so I want to talk about, obviously, like there are all of these really amazing like allegories about like nature and like all the nature themes. Stephanie, you wrote this episode. Can you talk to us a little bit about what inspired you to tell this story in particular?
Oh gosh, there's so much, but I mean, it's really about a well-meaning but misguided man who, like all of us, and especially how I've been feeling, is in this late capitalist society overworked and overly dependent on technology to the point where it's starting to damage his relationships to the things that matter most. And so nature comes in to set him on this harsh course correction. And for me, that just ties into so many of the anxieties that I have and so many of the things that were really weighing on my heart, but it also gave me the chance to kind of, you know, get into the kind of horror I really love. I love body horror. I love eco horror. And the type of writer I am, I don't get really clear ideas where I see the whole episode. It's more like a feeling, a thought, and I steep myself in different influences and then let something kind of emerge. And I had been listening to one of my favorite band of all time is Tool, and they have a song. They have a song called Enema.
Tool in a perfect circle. Yes. We can get it.
Their song Enema, he's talking about, you know, he's basically dumping on the soul sucking emptiness of capitalism. And so for me, I love monsters, and I loved kind of like the secret protagonist of this movie is kind of the plant for me.
Yo, that, and I mean, I am hashtag justice for Chris, hashtag Chris did nothing wrong. So Stephanie, like, what were your intentions for what viewers can take away from this episode?
I think we're all Chris and we're all Ben. We're all both of them. And the idea is like, we're in the broken system, like everything. And Vera and I have been talking a lot about social media this week and just, you know, the way we are in this capitalist society and like how everything is making us so self-reflective and efficient to the point where there are serious costs to our alienation from nature and our senses are diminished. We can't pay attention. We have more physical and emotional illnesses. I feel like there's so much that we want to change in ourselves, but we're unable to because it's a much bigger problem. And we're already seeing the ways that nature is kind of saying like, well, if you guys can't fix yourselves, this is what's going to happen. There are going to be these fires. There are going to be these floods.
Yeah. I mean, but true story, as we record this through our technologically mediated Zoom conversation in order to promote it on our social media platforms later, I'd like to talk a little bit more about production. So what were some of your fondest memories from this season of production and what were the challenges?
You know, this is the second season of the show in production during a pandemic. I mean, two seasons with no positive COVID cases.
That's amazing.
It's incredible. And I came in to direct on the second season. So this was a crew that already knew how to do this. And I'm a director who really prides myself on actually getting to know, hopefully by the course of, by the end of the production, every single person on the crew by name. It's very hard.
Girl,
with masks.
Same.
It's, and also
I'm like, I don't recognize you, lower half of your face. Person. You're a totally new person to me. I've never met you before. And they're like, we've been working together for 2 weeks. I'm like, well,
exactly. Masks and distancing. It is, you know, making, you know, what I love so much about, you know, making films, making television is the collaborative nature, you know, the relationships and the community that you build, you know, in the time in which you're working so intensely together. And you know, it's hard actually to not get to have that, frankly. And it's hard as a director to connect with your actors. And in this situation, right, I have a romance. I have a couple being featured in the episode who've actually been together for a while, are deeply in love and are actually at that sort of later stage of their relationship. And so, you know, we had to figure out creative ways to be able to work and rehearse and build that bond between the two of them before the camera started rolling. That wasn't like two people standing 6 feet apart with masks on their face, like no idea what it, you know, we really had to, we had to be creative and we had to figure out, you know, how to make that stuff work.
This episode gets into some truly disgusting body horror, which is also my personal favorite.
I think what was in the cauldron for that one, definitely a dose of Alien, a little bit of The Fly from Cronenberg. I don't know if you've seen Creepshow 2, but that lake oil spill blob.
Oh my God, that's my
Little Shop of Horrors.
Can I just say the lake, the blob in Creepshow 2 is when I grew up on a lake, and that messed me up because we had a raft floating in the middle of the lake, and it just like haunted me forever. So congratulations on a scarring moment for your inspiration.
Just, I love all that nasty stuff, but especially from Alien. You know, I love, there's something so primal and scary about that thing. And when it, you know, when the little, I forget what it's called, but the little guy shoots out of its mouth. And I think Vera did such a good job. I don't know. I think it's an image they put that is on Instagram, or it's out there somewhere. But the still shot from the episode where Christian is facing off with the plant, it just felt so alien to me. And I loved how Vera, because Vera actually, it's written very vaguely in the script. So Vera had to actually come up with the design with, it just had all of these elements. It shoots slime, you know, it has moving tentacles. So.
Right. Oh my God, so much slime. So Vera, like talking about that, like what was it like to be able to take all of that and like make it into real life?
Super fun. I knew that I wanted to have a situation in which we're exploring the ways in which plants are alive and, you know, and to sort of really build that in. So even the opening shot of the episode is actually a time lapse of flowers, you know, sort of, you know, that we took over the course of the shoot. So that we're looking at essentially the movement and the life and the motion of flowers, naturally speaking, no effects, right? Mm-hmm. And that sets the tone, because that was not an effects thing, that's life. You know, an interior life that we're not privy to and we actually choose not to tune into, right? So that becomes a setup. It needed to have like the huge bulb head. Mm-hmm. It actually is a head, right? There's a certain way in which the way that the plant grows over the course of the episode is meant to, you know, the alien reference is there, right? There is something animalistic because we can identify this head, right? But at the same time, I knew I wanted the tendrils to look like they came from a few different plants. Trying to get that thing to spew. And like it, that, you know, that was a lot of praying.
Can we talk about the Roomba for a second? Justice for the Roomba.
Yeah, and we both love dogs. You know, Vera and I are like animal people, and it's always the dogs in the horror movies. And so that was the little inside joke, right? It's like, how do we bring the dog trope into this?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. In the future, where we are all living in biodomes, I hope that none of us live with Pauly Shore. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you all so much for joining us. We are so glad that we can get you both onto the show because we are obviously such huge fans. Can both of y'all please tell folks what stories you are hoping to tell next? Stephanie, please start first.
I am working right now on an 80s fantasy inspired series. And I think what I'm most excited about is that tech is not a part of that world.
Yeah.
I have an Instagram account under the name tarot_obscuro. And I showcase a lot of my tarot work on there.
Okay, well, I'm going to join that immediately. Vera, you mentioned that you're like trying to like separate yourself from social media, but what other projects are you working on where people can find you easily?
I'm actually in the middle of hopefully shooting a feature this year. So sort of in that phase right now on the very early prep side, that's good where I'm going to be for this year.
Well, we can't wait to see what you do next. Thank you so much again, Vera and Stephanie, for joining us on the podcast. Danielle, that was such an awesome conversation with Vera, the creator of Two Sentence Horror Stories, and Stephanie, the writer of this episode. I mean, I just loved their perspective, their philosophical point of view on how we're relating to different kinds of intelligence nowadays.
Yeah, and like they, especially like both of them have such a perspective on our place as human beings in this existence. That's a really good episode and a great conversation. I was so like thankful, hashtag blessed, to be able to have it.
Coming up, we're joined by Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel, founder of Reboot and Recover.
Thank you so much, Dr. Diaz-Morel. We are so excited to have you here to talk about this and to talk about like all of the good work that you're doing. Like, we're super excited.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yay. Well, we especially are excited because when we learned about the work that your organization does, we knew we had to have you on the show. So can you tell us what prompted you to create the nonprofit organization Reboot and Recover?
So it all started over a decade ago in 2011. So at the time, I was a psychologist and I was working full time at a residential substance use treatment facility, working with children, adolescents, adults, and families. And in that work, I began to notice that people were more and more distracted with their devices. And mainly parents and caregivers would come into my office, and they'd come many of the times with their children, and we'd, you know, have a session or have to ask questions. And they would put a screen in front of their children to help distract them while we talked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the caregivers also would be distracted when they heard the sound of a notification. They would just jump and they'd want to check it right away. So, you know, starting to see this pattern in my work. So when I was a university student, I took a lot of courses on addiction. That was the area that I knew I wanted to specialize in. And, reading, you know, over 50 different kinds of scientific journal articles, including some case studies on the topic of technology addiction, and then starting to see some of these behaviors in my own practice, I was like, huh. And so at that point, it really became clear to me that technology was only going to become more involved in our lives. And with all of the good that technology brought, you know, increasing communication, and our ability to engage with others more easily or across the globe. You know, I had family that lived across the globe. I could contact them now quickly, and fun at leisure activities that we can engage in technology. It also brought a lot of not so good. So Reboot and Recover was founded in 2013, and we've been carrying out this message ever since, working in a prevention, education, treatment, and research on ways to help us live a balanced life in this ever-shifting technology-driven world.
So I have, I have ADHD, and so something I have had to do, I had to do it. I turn off all notifications.
Same.
Like, I can't do it when
I completely forget what I'm working on as soon as my brain goes completely blank. So I have to decide to look at it. You can't talk to me. I gotta find you out.
And like figure out a time when it's like, this is when I can take a 5-minute break, figure out what's going on. And it's also hard when like you have to be on Twitter for work. And so I think a lot of us have a dependency on technology and are trying to find ways to
mitigate like how that works with our actual life and what that means. And so for a lot of us, can you please tell us what exactly does technology addiction look like?
Yeah, like what's the difference between technology addiction and my social media jobs that require me to be technology addicted for 8 hours a day, please?
Right. And so there is a difference between casual overuse, which a lot of us do, especially right now, and someone who is addicted and getting that like dopamine thing. And there is a difference. So would you mind explaining to us what that
absolutely is? And, you know, I appreciate you sharing that too, because there are just, it's something that so many people really do struggle with, because technology, like I said, a lot of the good that came with it is this ability to be more creative, to work anytime, any place, but it's really shifted into this kind of expectation. A lot of it has to do with, you know, culture and society as well, of constantly being on, of constantly being connected. And what does that do to us, right? So technology addiction, it's really an umbrella term. And essentially, there are categories of technology-based addiction behaviors. And many of these categories are supported by evidence, like published research papers. It's been documented in case studies, and it's anecdotally shared with others in a variety of different support group settings or healthcare settings. So technology addiction can look like addiction to a smartphone. It can look like social media addiction. It can look like gaming disorder, which is classified in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5. It's a big mouthful. Basically, that is the book that healthcare professionals, right, medical professionals use to diagnose a mental disorder. And it's also listed in the World Health Organization's ICD-11 as a formal mental health disorder. So that one really has the most support. But technology addiction can also look like what we see, you know, in the episode of Plant Life, is that it can look like an over-reliance of technology for tasks of daily living. And this kind of addiction to constantly being busy or distracted. Yeah. And I think we see a lot of that in the episode. So some of the ways that it can manifest into this constant need for being busy or distracted really comes from a combination of psychological factors and from cultural or societal expectations. So, for example, one of the more common experiences for a person who might contact me or even someone who's just starting to think, is this really a problem in my life? Am I experiencing a technology-based addiction? One of the more common experiences is that they're using the distraction from that device to help cope with a part of their life. Right. So it's going from coping to escapism. And the escapism is I'm wanting to escape an unwanted feeling or a task. Right. I'm feeling overwhelmed with work. I'm feeling overwhelmed with a relationship. I'm feeling overwhelmed with school. I'm feeling overwhelmed with my feelings. So they really use this as a coping strategy where I'm going to escape and watch a series of really cute animal videos online, right? Or I'm going to watch a horror anthology because that's different than real life and it's interesting.
calling us out, Dr. Diaz-Marvel.
Well, no, well, that's fine. Man. We can use it as a coping strategy, absolutely. However, when it goes into this territory that we're starting to see it become more problematic and potentially addictive is when it's now a maladaptive coping mechanism, right? Where this is like the number one reason that we are using this as a form of escapism, right? Mm-hmm. So in like the episode of Plant Life, we can see how that person is struggling to stop and focus on their partner. And even though their partner has provided an ultimatum and said, if you continue this behavior, then, you know, this relationship is going to suffer. And that's telling the person who's overusing technology, there's a significant loss of a relationship that's important to me in my life if I'm not able to stop or reduce this behavior.
Yeah, it's like essentially like an intervention, like not like a formal one, but there is that thing of like, hey, this is unhealthy. I care about you. I'm telling you this is unhealthy. And this is the consequence of you continuing this is I can no longer enable this behavior.
again, it's like the air we breathe, right? Even people who were not technology reliant have learned to become so. Like, I taught my parents how to use a Zoom. That was a new one. So
that took a long time.
Yeah. But so how has that changed for what your organization does?
So before the pandemic, Reboot and Recover was providing telehealth services, which is kind of the new way, you know, to get healthcare, one of the primary ways. And it's always been a great way, again, to access people who might not be able to come into a face-to-face setting for a number of reasons, right? Maybe the building isn't ADA compliant and they need, you know, that requirement to get in.
Yep.
Or perhaps they're working three jobs and they're a single caregiver, and the only time they have available is 7 a.m., but they can't, you know, get to the office as well. So we've been offering telehealth before, and we continue to do so. But really, our mission remains the same, which is helping to find solutions for a balanced living in this technology-driven world. It's just the technology has shifted more so. So some of the ways in which we could find that balance before is going to look a little bit different. You know, engaging in Zoom calls when, you know, face-to-face interaction isn't available, but still finding other ways to cope with the ongoing collective traumatic stress that we're all feeling from a global pandemic at a time when we're just grieving so many things that we used to be able to do that we can't anymore, you know, ceremonies and rites of passages. So like graduations, you know, celebrations of life. If someone's having a child, they wanted to have a shower or celebration, right? It's not available anymore. People who are getting married and want to celebrate those things. These are all things that we can't do in the same space that we were able to do before March of 2020. And so there's a lot of stress that comes with that. But we found some outlets through, you know, the technology that can help us with that. But even so, at the beginning of the pandemic, I could say that it was really difficult for, you know, some of the people personally that I was treating and others that I know who were treating them as well, because they had tried to really abstain a lot and now had to reintroduce the technology. So it was like, now we've got to adjust and find a new balance. But here we are. Almost 2 years later, which is very odd to say. I don't think many of us thought we would be here almost 2 years later. But
as a horror fan, I was like, it's going to be back forever. I was like, no, I have hope. I was like, I've seen this movie.
You expected it. You know, but here we are almost 2 years later. And I thought a lot of people are saying, you know, enough with the connection through technology. They're really yearning again for that physical connection. So now it's shifted from how do we find that balance to how do we find that balance reintegrating technology into our lives to how do we find that balance of coping with the stress, now trying to take out a bit of that overuse of technology when it's become so expected. To celebrate, you know, life or just in so many facets of our lives.
Yeah. Especially because we're talking about people who have already had tech addiction because now they're having to deal with, I am so like, I have to be dependent on this again. And I have already been trying so hard to like break my dependence on this. So how do people who have acknowledged and are working on that addiction deal with it now that it is such a like part of our lives that we have to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So every person really has been struggling a lot with it. And I can tell you that I've gotten a lot of extra calls and contacts from individuals in the past year because of, you know, when the beginning of the pandemic and they had to start using technology too much, where now they're starting to develop that over-reliance and really missing the social connectedness that you get when you're in the same room as somebody, which doesn't always feel the same as when we're talking to someone through a screen.
You know, I used to co-write with friends and I'd be like, just come, like, we'll just meet in a coffee shop. Just put your body near me. Because then my distraction is chatting with you instead of spiraling online. I was like, it actually saves me time to like to take a break by chatting with a person. And, but I can't do that anymore. So it's more online spiraling.
Absolutely.
You know?
So some of the ways that, you know, those who are experiencing technology addiction, either for the first time they're coming to realize it, or they have been experiencing it and are now coping with the pandemic where they are using an increase of technology because of the social isolation, is that they've found new hobbies and ways to cope. So, you know, everyone, of course, is going for a walk now, but also just engaging in things that perhaps were lost before. I have, you know, several individuals who really enjoy crocheting, who have gotten into crossword puzzles. I have one person who started designing their own crossword puzzles, which is really cool. Yes. Oh, so, you know, like finding and rediscovering new hobbies. Do you remember at the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was baking bread?
Yes.
Oh. Right.
And the good thing about baking bread is it makes your fingers too sticky to touch a phone. I've been loving watercolors. That was my pandemic thing because it occupied my mind and my hand, and I had to look at like and touch something physical. So I feel that. Yeah, I'm a terrible knitter.
Knitting was my thing. I got into knitting.
Oh, you got into knitting? I found my medical oddities book and would like interpret it in watercolor, and it was very gross and soothing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Need to see those.
No, you don't.
Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morrell, the founder of Reboot and Recover, thank you so much. This has been such an illuminating conversation. And the conversation is not over. It does not end. If you want more information about that organization, you can visit rebootandrecover.org.
Thank you so much.
Oh my God, this was so good.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What an awesome conversation with Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morrell. I loved her insight into how they're using these same philosophies to disconnect us from tech, even though now we're more connected than ever.
I absolutely 100% agree. I think a lot of people who are trying to get therapy through the pandemic have like tried to deal with people who are like, I don't know how telehealth works. And so to have someone, especially like in this space, and the fact that she has said that so many people who they are working with are people who are like, oh, I understand addiction. I understand other things. There is no shame. And there is like a way to work it where like, obviously you still have to have technology to like live and be a person, but like you can make it so you aren't dependent on it for, you know, the way that you feel.
Coming up, we're joined by Jeffrey Reddick.
Jeffrey, hi. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us today. We are so completely psyched that you're here. Like, we can't believe it.
Thanks for having me. I don't take compliments well. I get all blushy and stuff. So, but thank you.
Oh, then buckle up, buddy, because we're about to make you uncomfortable. For those who don't know, Jeffrey is the creator of the Final Destination franchise. So if you've been, you know, living under a rock or just like completely unaware of one of the most iconic concepts in horror history, Jeffrey, can you tell the audience the simplified premise behind the films?
Of course. Yeah. The simple premise is someone has a premonition that allows them to cheat death, whether it be somebody on a plane who gets on the plane and has a premonition the plane's going to crash, someone who gets on a highway and has a premonition there's going to be a highway crash. And so they avoid the situation, in essence, cheating death.
Okay.
And then
I love this so much. I have to tell you this. I'm so sorry. This is like, I'm such a fan of these films.
Danielle has her own Final Destination moment.
I was crossing the street in downtown LA and I got hit by a bus and woke up in a gutter.
Oh.
And yeah.
It's just like this is a thing that happened.
And I forget that, like,
oh,
I have to like give people a second to absorb it.
Like, yeah. It's nothing.
So
a bus
that
hit
was,
me.
I'm a stand-up comic. And so I tell the story. And when I tell it, one of my things is like, what if this is my Final Destination moment, where it's like, you know, all of a sudden I'm going to be stalked by like a bus. Like, I'm walking across the street and there's like a bus, like wearing a trench coat, like two kids like stalking after me. Or like, I go to get married one day, you know, my groom or bride, whoever it is, I don't care what gender you are. I just want to get married to someone who will let me live in sweats. And then they all of a sudden I hear like a honk honk out of the background and they take off their skin suit and they're a bus. And so that's always been like kind of my like, oh yeah, this is my Final Destination moment. That bus is coming after me. And so I love so much about this premise. And obviously like
there is a death that I obviously really identify with. But what was your inspiration for that first film?
My inspiration, I'm sorry, because yeah, when Terry Chaney gets hit by that bus, she doesn't just go into a gutter. So I'm glad you didn't.
Yes. Honestly, one of the best, yes, one of the best comic timings of like any movie ever. The timing of that death is so funny to me, but I might be sick. So sorry, please answer Danielle's question.
I came up with the general germ of the idea. I was actually flying home to visit my mom in Kentucky. And I read an article about a woman who's was on vacation and her mother called her and said, don't take that flight that you're on tomorrow. I have a bad feeling about it. So she took the flight or she changed flights and the plane that she was supposed to be on crashed. And so that just put the idea in the back of my head. You know, like I didn't have a story for it, but I was like, that's really interesting. Like she could have died in that. And then later on, when I first moved to New York, I was trying to find an actor or a writing agent. And, you know, you had to write a spec script for a show that was already on the air. So I was a big fan of The X-Files and I was trying to think of like, yes, absolutely. And it's so karmic that James Wong and Glenn Morgan, who did some of my favorite episodes of The X-Files, came on the first Final Destination and they did a good rewrite and James Wong directed it. I had an idea for Final Destination or for the X-Files spec script. And so I used that idea as the setup. I had Scully's brother, Charles, who's like the brother we never saw. have the premonition. And then I showed it to my friends and I worked at New Line Cinema who did like A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is my favorite movie. And my friends at New Line were like, don't, you know, this is a feature idea. So I wrote it up as a feature. And then one of my friends, Chris Bender, who worked with me at New Line, started working for these two producers, Warren Zeide and Craig Perry. And they were looking for horror. So I sent them over a couple of ideas and this is the one that they landed on. So it was a very interesting journey. The X-Files script is actually online. If you Google it, I think it's on bloodydisgusting.com, which is a website that I...
Oh, excuse me? I know what my homework's going to be because I was a huge X-Files fan growing up, so I got to look that up. But you were talking a little bit about, you know, your relationship with New Line and how they were the ones that discovered it. So, you know, we heard from our producers that when you were 14, you wrote a 10-page treatment of a prequel to A Nightmare on Elm Street and sent it to New Line. So can you walk us through that incredibly baller move by 14-year-old Jeffrey?
You know, I wish this Jeffrey had the balls of 14-year-old Jeffrey.
we're going to live forever.
Yeah, we're fearless. And the funny thing is, like, I always talk about this because I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. So I'm like this 14, not only am I a 14-year-old, I'm like a 14-year-old hillbilly that has no concept of how Hollywood works. I saw A Nightmare on Elm Street with one of my friends, and it's so funny. We were too poor to go to the theater, and we sat on his dad's big truck and turned on the CB and illegally watched it before, you know, being illegally downloads were cool. And yeah, I saw the movie, and it just blew, like, because from the trailer, I didn't realize this till later, but the print had gotten washed out in the printing process, so the movie was a little faded. So when I saw the trailer on TV, I'm like, oh, it looks kind of cheap in the hands. So my expectations were like zero. And that movie scared the crap out of me. Like, I terrified me. It's my favorite movie to this day. Heather Langenkamp is my favorite final girl. And Fred, you know, Robert Englund is, it's just amazing. So I went home and I like typed up a prequel and I called information in New York and got the phone number for New Line. And then I found out who was the president and I just mailed it to him. And and he
this
sent
is exactly
back.
How Hollywood works, guys.
Here's the thing. They won't read it because they can't read it because then it opens up liabilities.
Well, that's what happened.
But yes, it's
the
amazing.
Funny thing is, but that's what happened. He sent it back to me and said, you know, they couldn't read unsolicited material. And I'm like, what the hell does unsolicited mean? So I had to look that one up. I was only 14. And so I sent it back to him and I said, excuse me, sir, but I've spent $3 on your movie. So I think you can take 5 minutes to read my story. And he did.
Oh, wow.
Excuse me.
And it was a different time back then. I mean, this was the great thing is New Line blew up because of Nightmare on Elm Street. So I got them like at that special time where Bob Shea would have time to read stuff coming in. And so I just stayed in touch with him and his assistant, and they would send me movie posters, and they were just very encouraging. Like, that's all you need when you're encouraged, or when you're young, is that encouragement. When I went to New York at 19, I was originally studying acting, and so I got a summer internship at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and New Line offered me an internship for the summer. And then I ended up getting an agent. I'm like, screw school. I'm going to stay in New York and be a new act, big actor. That was my dream. But the acting thing didn't work out because, you know, non-traditional casting was not a thing in the 90s. So my agent was very nice. But she's like, look, I can't, unless you rap or play basketball. And this is, you know, it sounds mean today, but it was just the reality. She's like, unless you rap or play basketball, like, there's really no parts for you because you're like a, you know, you're like an ethnic boy next door. And I could try to get you on the Cosby Show. Yep. And I was like, yeah, but that's it. So yeah. I was like, well, I'll just write stuff. You know, I'll just write and then I'll just be in my stuff. And, you know, as I got older, I kept writing about teens getting killed. So, you know, that didn't work out. But
I keep getting older, but the teens I kill in my movies stay the same age. Right?
Yeah. I think it's a story of not only being persistent, but also the thing I always tell people is when I got to New Line, because they had always complimented me on my writing, encouraged me. But when I got to New Line, I was actually able to look up the coverage for my stuff that I'd been sending. And the coverage was awful. It was like,
Oh my God.
And the lesson from that is, though, is people have to understand, like, you have to grow and evolve, whether you're a writer, actor, whatever kind of artist you are. When you're young, you think you're great, but you realize it takes time and it takes rejection. If I'd have read that coverage when I'd sent the stuff in, I would have been like, oh, I'm horrible, I'm going to quit. But by the time I got to New Line, I was better. And I'm like, okay, I have to learn to take constructive criticism. And I'm not going to come out of the gate being like a great writer or a great actor or a great, I don't care what my high school, you know, acting teacher tells me, you know, of course, you know, you have to grow and get better.
Okay, so obviously this is a horror podcast and we are like major horror boos. That is our whole thing. In the literal case of when they say when you're writing, you have to be open to killing your children, which in writing means something completely different. Like, that means, like, you know, don't want any precious ideas, like, let them go. But in this case, you're just like literally killing your children. So do you have a favorite death in the Final Destination franchise? And if you had to go out just like them, would that change what you pick?
Well, my favorite death is Todd getting hung in the shower in the first movie, because I think it's so, because the Chad Donnelly, he does such a good job with that scene, and it's so real that it's hard for me to watch. It's just really hard for me to watch. So I appreciate it, and I think, again, James and Glenn did a great job with the way that whole scene plays out and it was directed and everything. So that one's so visceral for me. The one that made me go, oh shit, was the gymnastic scene in the fifth movie. Because the way that ends, you know she's going to get it, but when she falls and like crunches it, I literally like yelled out, holy shit, you know, in the theater. And I never do that.
Well, what I like about the Final Destination deaths is that you're like, is it going to be the outlet? Is it going to be the water? Are they going to get hung? And like, you see, you like try to figure it out. And then it's always like it turns in a way you don't expect, which is kind of what I like also about Two Sentence Horror Stories, right? Like, it goes one notch beyond what I would expect the horror logic to be. So since this is a podcast about Two Sentence Horror Stories, you watched the episode Plant Life, right?
Yeah. I've watched all the episodes, but yes, I did watch Plant Life, and I really enjoyed it. You know, it's, first of all, it was very nice to see, you know, a gay couple represented, you know, in a series, and also, you know, people, a diverse cast. And I want to just have a little quick conversation about diversity, because it's weird. A lot of times when people hear diversity, people start complaining, oh, it's woke or it's this or what. And I just like to explain to people, again, I started acting in the 90s. And back then, and I'm light skinned, which gives me a lot of, you know, I'm half black and half white. So I'm light skinned. So that opened a lot more doors for me than, you know, my darker skinned brothers and sisters. But back in even the 90s, like, there were no opportunities, because the default for casting in films is white people. And that's no slamming them. That's just always been the default. Like, I wrote the lead for Final Destination 2 to be a black actress. Cause I was like, the first film, I'm like, we're in New York, the most diverse city in the world. So let's just, for the first film, let's diversify the cast. And they didn't. Like, it was all white kids. And you're never going to find a class in New York that's all white kids. So that's just been the default for like leads in any kind of film for so long, but I've been in the rooms where Black actress or actor, a Middle Eastern, a Muslim, a Latino person came in and they were like, that's the best actor, but we can't cast them because it won't play in Middle America and it won't play internationally. So I have to explain that to people. I have to explain that to people because that's the business decision behind the why they didn't pick the best actor or actress. So what is happening now is people are saying, you know what? We've always looked at this pool of people for the lead roles and stuff. But now we're realizing, oh, there's a whole ocean of people. And now they're just shining a light on the other talent that is just has always been great. That's just been the business reality that we've faced for so long. People of color weren't considered at all for lead roles. They just, no matter how nice everybody in Hollywood and progressive, they
That's amazing. Thank you so much for that insight. I do want to talk about the ending of Plant Life, which, spoilers, if anyone has not watched it yet, which, what are you doing? Go watch the episode. It's really, really freaking good. Hardworking workaholic Christian becomes a full-ass plant. He seems like he might be content with it. It might just be that he's a plant, and so, like, maybe he has limited emotions. So what did you think about the ending?
It's weird because I'm single, so I was like, well, now he's gonna be a plant his whole life. And like you said, and then I'm like, and men's gonna be like just feeding him, but can't hug him, can't cuddle with him. So it was for somebody who's grown up on like Tales from the Crypt and Tales from the Dark Side, it was a twisted ending that works as that bittersweet kind of twisted body horror kind of image. But then it, you know, it's like Valentine's Day is coming up. So the bitter, the bitter jerk in me was like, well, you're not with a person now, you're with the plant. So you should be with the person to be happy. I'm kind of joking. So, so if they're happy, I'm happy for them.
Look, if they like it, I love it. But like, I don't, hashtag, I've already said this, justice for Christian. Christian did nothing wrong. Christian's a hard worker. And like, I get it.
Yeah.
That's where I land. Well, don't turn me into a plant because I'm a busy bitch.
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting thing because I think the relationship was just one where it wasn't working. So they should have just parted ways because people stay in like unhealthy relationships for too long. But it's like, yeah, I mean, Christian was a workaholic, but that was him. And, you know, when you love somebody, you kind of either have to take them for what they are or.
And Ben wasn't like trying to turn him into a plant. This wasn't one of those things where it was like, you need to be a plant now so that I can like control you. It just like, it just so happened to be that it was like, oh, you're a plant now. So now we get to like have cottage core and like the backyard, except you're like you're the literal yard. Core of the college. Yeah. The yard. Yeah. And I'm reading things to you and it's like, I do imagine like, would you like some more tea? And it's like, I can't. Oh, it's like, oh, you're going to drink some more tea. Just like make some lemonade and like, all right. So in this page of Sense and Sensibility, you know, but again, Ben like didn't mean to. Ben's not a bad guy. No. He just made a weird decision. Don't take things inside that are outside unless they are cats.
But there could be evil cats too. Yeah. It was interesting because obviously the plant was a metaphor, but the plant was weird because it reminded me a little bit of, you know, Audrey from Little Shop of Horrors. When I saw the plant, I was like, that plant's no good. Plant's no good.
He could tell. The Final Destination guy knows where the death is hidden.
That plant is nothing but trouble.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for talking with us. This has been so much fun. Obviously, we could talk to you about the many ways you can kill a teen on film for hours. Please tell us where people can follow you or find you online.
Absolutely. And also, thank you all for having me. This stuff does actually make me super happy because I love talking to the fans and just it's really a two-way street with this. So thank you. I've kind of stayed off Facebook. People could find me on Twitter at Jeffrey A. Reddick. And I'm the same thing on Instagram. The new Final Destination is being worked on right now. It's going to be on HBO Max, which is exciting.
Oh my God.
Follow me on there. And one is Usagi Yojimbo, which is, it's based on the Usagi Yojimbo comic book. We have a series coming out on Netflix that I wrote on this year. So we'll be announcing stuff about that.
Thank you so much. I don't care if we're doing a podcast. We'll have everyone come back and we'll make one.
Thank you all for having Megan and Danielle. It was great talking to you.
Daniel, what an incredible show today. I feel like we hit all of the bases between talking to our expert, the creators, and then the incredible, thoughtful, hilarious Jeffrey Reddick. I'm just like, my cup is full.
I can't handle how much fun I had both watching this episode and getting to talk to all of the amazing people we talked to this episode. This has been such a delight. I can't wait to do this again. Oh, it turns out we get to another couple of times.
Yeah.
Hey, look at us.
Best job ever. Best job ever. So thank you to Vera Miao, Stephanie Adams Santos, Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel, and Jeffrey Reddick for joining us on the pod.
This is Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast. Catch you next time. Thank you for listening to Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts so you never miss an episode.
Two Sentence Horror Stories, the podcast is a Stage 13 original series hosted by me, Daniel Radford.
And me, Megan Rosati. Don't forget to watch Season 3 of Two Sentence Horror Stories on the CW and CWTV.com and stream Seasons 1 and 2 on Netflix.
Check out more on the show at stage13.com and be sure to follow Two Sentence Horror Stories on Instagram at Two Sentence Horror Stories for the latest updates on the podcast and show, and on our Facebook page at Two Sentence Horror Stories to connect with other fans of the show and share your thoughts on this season.